Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fate of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who is in custody in the UK, facing extradition to the United States, and speak with Mike Harris, the publisher of Little Atoms, who writes on human rights, surveillance, and free speech. He joins us to discuss his article at the UK Independent, Julian Assange Should Be Deported, but not to Trump's America, and look into whether the case against Assange in Sweden, which was dropped, could be revived, presumably after the courts in the UK have dealt with Assange's bail-jumping case. Either way, it would seem that there will be a protracted legal battle over Assange's extradition to face charges in the US, which the indictment says were, quote, part of the conspiracy that Assange encouraged Chelsea Manning to provide information and records from departments and agencies of the US government. We'll assess whether these charges were deliberately constructed to avoid the claim that Assange is a journalist, an issue now at the center of the debate about whether Assange's journalism is credible any longer, given his close cooperation with the Russians to help tip the scales in Trump's favor in the 2016 elections. With many in the U.S. diplomatic and intelligence community seething from WikiLeaks' dump of diplomatic cables and the trove of the CIA's top secrets from the Vault 7 release, we'll explore what the real motives are for trying to get Assange into U.S. custody. Then, with today's announcement by Mayor Pete of South Bend, Indiana, that he is entering the presidential race, where he's already polling as the third most popular Democratic hopeful after Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, we'll discuss Pete Buttigieg's political background and local reputation with David Courtright, Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He joins us to examine the meteoric rise of Mayor Pete and why thousands are braving the terrible weather in South Bend today to attend his presidential launch. Then finally, we look into why Trump is encouraging lawlessness and promoting vindictive and petty policies to punish his political enemies by using asylum seekers as weapons, demanding sanctuary cities take care of them, quote, at the highest level, especially by the state of California, which is well known for its poor management and high taxes. May Nye, professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, joins us to discuss how an increasingly reckless Trump is using poor, desperate immigrants to distract us from his misrule and the damaging and damning evidence about to emerge from the Mueller report in spite of Barr's efforts to censor it. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from the UK is Mike Harris, who's the CEO of 89UP and the publisher of Little Atoms, who writes on human rights, surveillance, and free speech. He has run high-profile campaigns in Belarus and Azerbaijan and has worked with the Don't Spy on Us campaign and the documentary film company Brit Doc on the Oscar-nominated film Citizen Four. He has an article at the UK Independent, Julian Assange Should Be Deported, but Not to Trump's America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Harris.
Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Well, thanks, Mike. And in terms of the work that you've done on elections, political campaigns in Belarus and Azerbaijan, I'm assuming that you're not working for the dictators, particularly in Belarus. You'd be working against them.
No.
Right.
Yeah, with the opposition. Yeah, sure. I went for I had lunch with quite a prominent member of the opposition, a former presidential candidate, in fact, 10 days ago. And he explained to me how the crisis in Belarus is still a frozen crisis, and nobody, not NATO, not the EU, wants to really do anything to promote either human rights or democracy, which is a real shame.
Well, you know, Lukashenko is a thug, and he seems to have some kind of arrangement with Putin. And, you know, he's Putin's kind of guy. So it does seem like a frozen situation, but it does play into the Assange story, because one of the things that apparently offended you was that Assange passed highly sensitive U.S. embassy cables to the dictatorship of Belarus, which was used to prosecute brave opposition activities. So was that the tipping point for you in terms of having a not such a romantic view of Assange, which many people have, but rather a kind of skeptical view of him?
Yeah, and what made it worse was we had credible information that cables had been passed to Assange associate, a guy that calls himself Israel Shamir, who is a hardened anti-Semite. He's a Holocaust denier. And he had been given these Belarusian cables. So we had good intelligence that both he'd been given these cables, but also we had photographic evidence of him outside the presidential administration in Minsk in Belarus, where, you know, he had met members of the Lukashenko's inner circle. And then shortly after his visit, Lukashenko announces he's forming his own version of WikiLeaks, which would implicate the opposition in crimes committed during the election. So I think, it, you know, and from my perspective at that point, it looked very likely that Assange had given Shamir access to the cable. Shamir had passed them on to the dictatorship of Belarus, and then they were used in the prosecution of opposition figures. So that then goes from being, WikiLeaks activity being journalistic activity to actually willingly abetting a dictator's prosecution of the opposition.
Well, it's pretty clear that Assange and WikiLeaks have never really dumped anything critical of Russia or China, for that matter. Their server is in St. Petersburg. So it's pretty difficult not to notice that there's a sort of Russian connection here, not the least of which was dumping all of that stuff hacked from the DNC and from campaign manager of Hillary Clinton's at very strategic moments during the 2016 campaign, particularly when the Access Hollywood tape emerged just before the election, where Trump was boasting about grabbing women's private parts and how, as a celebrity, he could get away with it. Within half an hour of that damaging information hitting the media here in the United States, suddenly WikiLeaks dumps the Podesta hack. So what's the mood in England, or at least the – I know it's probably split, but what's the sense of how much this guy is a hero or a whore of the Russians?
There's a very strong feeling actually here that – I mean, people here kind of want to separate out the charges. So they want to – there's a big debate happening at the moment about Assange, and actually kind of common sense opinion is moving that he needs to face the allegations in Sweden, the allegations of sexual assault and rape. That's very strong. There's a very strong feeling that he should be prosecuted for breaching his bail conditions. And then where public opinion splits is around the deportation to the US. That's the kind of bit where opinion is far more mixed, with some senior conservatives thinking that he should be deported to the US in line with the extradition order. Whereas I'm a little bit more, I have some reservations about Assange going to the US, and that's even though I think he colluded with the Russians to try and sway opinion towards Trump against Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential elections. Even though I think he is probably either very close to Russian intelligence or an actual tool and asset of Russian intelligence, and that's also even though Assange has shown himself to behave in a way that no responsible journalist or no responsible editor would behave in. And the reason for me having a slight reservation about Assange being deported is the way that Chelsea Manning, the solitary confinement, the long prison sentence that was only commuted by President Obama as a presidential pardon that got Manning out of prison. It wasn't, Manning hadn't served her full sentence. So I have a little bit of a reservation of what's going to be thrown and the impact that could have on public interest whistleblowing, although this is a very, very complicated case where Assange has gone well beyond what would be arguably defended under the, you know, arguably protected under the First Amendment, the First Amendment of the US Constitution, and also has those very close connections to hostile states, which, you know, is not where the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Guardian is, you know, it's not where they're at. But I sense the deportation of Assange to the US would send a very chilling signal to people that wish to handle future leaks from key US government departments.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Harris, who's in the UK, where he's the CEO of 89UP and the publisher of Little Atoms, who writes on human rights, surveillance and free speech. He has run high-profile campaigns on Belarus and Azerbaijan and has worked with the Don't Spy on Us campaign and documentary film company BritDoc on the Oscar-nominated film Citizen 4. And he has an article at the UK Independent, Julian Assange Should Be Deported But Not to Trump's America. Of course, the big media outlets that you mentioned, the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., and The Guardian, they all willingly published everything that they could get their hands on from the hack of the GRU, which were dumped by WikiLeaks. So I don't know whether that's complicity, but what's your sense of the Swedish rape case? The Swedes already dropped that. So could they revive the case? Is that a way to get Sweden, get Assange away from being sent to the United States?
I think it's looking increasingly likely like Sweden will call for Assange to be extradited. If he is extradited to Sweden, then, and this was always a misrepresentation put forward from his lawyers, is that his lawyers and Assange supporters always said he mustn't go to Sweden. Now, this is the reason he's been holed up in an embassy, remember, for the last 7 years. This is support said, well, if he goes to Sweden, he'll be deported to the US, and it's more likely he would be deported to the US than from the UK. That's a complete legal nonsense. The same human rights protections apply in both countries. And in fact, if Assange does go to Sweden, there'll be a double lock on extradition, because if Assange is in Sweden and prosecuted for the allegations put forward, but if that happens, to deport him to the US at that point, we'll need the US judiciary signing off for the extradition warrant and the UK, and it to be approved by the UK authorities. So actually, Assange going to Sweden could be the thing that stops him going to the United States of America, even if he does end up facing being jailed. So it's a very complicated picture. But what Assange's supporters haven't pointed out is, in fact, there are lots of legal remedies, lots of legal mechanisms open to him to avoid going to the US. And in fact, he should have gone to Sweden when the two women first made those allegations.
Well, it would seem, though, that the US, I don't know about the UK, but I can imagine the US would be lobbying the Swedish government pretty hard not to revive the rape case. They want him badly here in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, there's been a very close alignment between what happened with the government of Ecuador, the government of the US, and the UK government's announcement around Assange being arrested. That was obviously choreographed, and the Swedish authorities were not told that Assange was being arrested at the embassy. So there seems to be some choreography from those three countries, less so on the Swedish side. And then, in fact, yes, I mean, if it goes through the, Assange could face a year in prison for breaching his bail conditions, so he could go to prison. In that period of time, legal experts say it could take up to 2 years for Assange to be deported from the UK to the US, because it will go all the way up to the Supreme Court, no doubt. It could even go to the Council of Europe. It could go to the European Court of Human Rights. So there's a very long legal process to get Assange to the US. Meanwhile, these women want justice. So I think even if, I think it would make a bit of a mockery of justice if Assange wasn't taken to Sweden. In fact, it's going to take a very long time for the US to get Assange to the US in any case.
But do you think that it's if the women who I thought basically gave up on it, but if these two women in Sweden want justice, as you said, I imagine the Swedish authorities are thinking to themselves, do we really need this hot potato?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if Assange goes to Sweden and the charges are, well, if he goes to Sweden, he could end up in jail in Sweden. And while that's happening, the Swedish government and the Swedish courts are going to have to go through a process where, you know, Assange's lawyers are going to throw absolutely everything in order to prevent his deportation to the US. To be honest, I think, you know, and again, you know, I think it's very sad that people around Assange said to Ed Snowden that he should go to Moscow because he'd be safer there. Actually, any European country, you've got the European Court of Human Rights, you've got very high protections for whistleblowers and freedom of speech, although arguably not as strong as the First Amendment, but to actually deport Assange to the US, where his lawyers are going to argue, you know, look at what happened to Chelsea Manning, cruel and, you know, cruel treatment, degrading treatment. Actually, I think it's very unlikely that Assange is actually ever going to be deported to the US unless he enters US soil of his own free will. So it's I sense this has always been a little bit of an argument used by Assange's supporters, and I think the reality is it's going to be next to impossible for the US to get him deported. And if not impossible, it will be a very long legal process. We may still be talking about this in 10 years' time.
Oh, good Lord. Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Mike Harris, obviously the US, the indictment that they unsealed is about essentially colluding with Chelsea Manning to break into the DOD's computer, and that is under a criminal statute. It has nothing to do with the First Amendment, which is obviously they were avoiding the idea that this was a punishment for Assange's journalistic activities and releasing the collateral. What was it called again? The video of the in Iraq of the
Iraq war logs.
Yeah, that one. So my understanding is that what's really going on here is that the U.S. intelligence community are just furious with Assange for his data dump of the so-called Vault 7 documents, which was a whole extraordinary amount of information and the actual hacking tools and cyber tools of the CIA cyber espionage secrets, which very shortly after that release of the Vault 7 documents, Pompeo, then the head of the CIA, went public with his attack on WikiLeaks, saying it's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors like Russia. So it's highly coincidental, is it not? So do you think that's the real motive here? That I'm going to be talking tomorrow with William Arkin, who has been writing about this connection to Vault 7. And for reasons I don't quite know, I'll ask Bill why The Guardian refused to publish his piece. But what do you make of that as a more likely motive on the part of the US to get their hands on Assange?
I mean, it's difficult to say because Hillary Clinton and, you know, the State Department and CIA under Obama were very keen to prosecute, never said that they would not prosecute Assange for the Iraq War leaks, even though there was a very clear public interest. I felt there was a very clear public interest defense around the Iraq War logs. So the problem is you have you have the over-prosecution of whistleblowers under President Obama, which doesn't give much faith. But then simultaneously, then you have the movement of Assange into being basically a key asset of the Russians. And so you can sort of defend elements of Assange's behavior, but there is this tipping point where he does actually get very, very close to being a willing agent of the Russian government, which, you know, I mean, is he an extension of the Russian intelligence services? It's hard to say with some of his leaks. This muddies the water. So then you see simultaneously the over-prosecution of whistleblowers for public interest Warlock.
Sorry, did you break up there? You still with us, Mark? I think we lost the connection. Are you back yet with us, Mike? And can you just quickly say hello? And otherwise, we'll.
Yeah.
Oh, you're back. So, what were you going to just finish up? Your the last little bit was cut out by static.
Sorry. So just there's a difference between the sort of earlier Assange leaks, which were, I think you could argue, public interest. I think you could argue he was acting in a journalistic way. And the later leaks, in particular the leaks during the US presidential election, where you might argue some journalistic merit in them. But once he gets closer and closer and closer to being almost a Russian state asset, this is the bit where it calls into question, you know, potentially his First Amendment rights. The issue is the US authorities are not separating these out and saying, we will not prosecute for the Iraq war logs. We will not prosecute for the US State Department cables. However, we are going to prosecute here, here, and here. That actually would be a more moral case to give to the rest of the world. I think it's important the US does set a high standard for free speech because of its constitution, its important role as a leading global democracy. If it doesn't do that, then Assange's supporters can continue to say, well, look, he's being prosecuted for public interest journalism. And that means, you know, and once again, that's a case that means that he may not be deported.
Well, Mike Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thanks, Roger.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Harris, the CEO of 89UP and the publisher of Little Adams, who writes on human rights, surveillance, and free speech. He's run high-profile campaigns in Belarus and Azerbaijan and has worked with the Don't Spy on Us campaign and the documentary film company BritDoc on the Oscar-nominated film Citizen 4. And he has an article at the UK Independent, Julian Assange should be deported, but not to Trump's America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's announcement by Mayor Pete of South Bend, Indiana, that he's entering the presidential race. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Courtwright, who's Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, as well as the Chair of the Board of the Fourth Freedom Forum. He's the author and co-editor of 19 books, including Civil Society, Peace and Power, and Drones and the Future of Armed Conflict. And his latest book is Governance for Peace. He also is the editor of Peace Policy, an online journal published by the Kroc Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Courtwright.
Thank you, Ian. How are you?
Well, thanks, David. And have you talked to your wife at all? I know she's off at the rally or the announcement of Pete Buttigieg's presidential race.
Yeah, big day here in South Bend. There are thousands of people in town, and I left her off a couple hours ago in a very cold rain, in a long line of thousands of people waiting to get into the old factory building that's been renovated and turned into a new industrial hub in downtown where Pete is making his announcement. And she says it's so crowded she can hardly even see the stage. So it's a great and a very exciting day here in South Bend.
Has the announcement actually happened?
It's going on now. I have the video on my live stream. The preliminary speakers are talking now, but Pete will be on shortly, and it's available live streaming from Pete for President. So, yeah.
Well, I have to say that he is surprising. I know when I first heard that the mayor of South Bend was running, I I was perhaps dismissive. You know, there's in the history of American presidential elections, I don't believe anybody from the Congress has ever been elected president, let alone a mayor. And I think that was probably, you know, I was probably being, you know, sort of arrogant in that way that a lot of sort of political pundits are in dismissing somebody out of hand before I knew who he was. But as you get to know this guy from what little I've seen of him on TV, I'm absolutely astounded at how clear his thinking is, that he doesn't speak like a politician. He speaks in very profound ways. He's actually very thoughtful and careful, but also inspiring.
He is, and I think it reflects the fact that people are hungry for leadership that has integrity, someone who's authentic and tells a story in an honest and compelling way. And that's certainly Pete's story. You know, we all now are becoming familiar with it. But, you know, Rhodes Scholar, Harvard graduate, linguist of seven languages, concert pianist, and all of that. But also someone who's able to take the issues that we face now and articulate them in a way that's very progressive, but is not ideological, that somehow manages to avoid being seen as either left or right, but as real common sense for how we could try to fix the many problems we have in the country. And that's sort of the way he's handled the problems of an old industrial city like South Bend, just working together with all the different parts of the community, trying to work step by step to rebuild the inner city and attract investment for new developments and try to create jobs more equitably. And, you know, it's starting to have an impact here, and people really love him right here in the city. And I guess we were all surprised as well when he said that he was going to consider running for president. But we've been used to this, you know, quiet and surprising eloquence and insight that he reflects on so many of his commentaries, and impressed at how broad his erudition is and how creative his thinking is in terms of addressing all of the issues that we're facing in the country in an innovative way, in a progressive way, in a way that's not divisive and that has, I hope, a chance of actually drawing people into the debate rather than dividing us from one side or the other.
Well, he's actually starting a very important debate with, in a sense, by distinguishing himself from Mike Pence in terms of Pence wearing his religion on his sleeve and Mayor Pete saying, I'm a Christian too, and your hatred of gays and LGBTQ, et cetera, is in fact un-Christian. I'm not doing justice to what he actually says, because again, the guy is extremely articulate. But let me just read a little bit of a transcript of an interview he did with Vice, where he was asked about saying, you know, you don't have a lot of specific policy ideas, and Buttigieg said, part of where the left and the center-left have gone wrong is that we've been so policy-led that we haven't been as philosophical. We like to think of ourselves as the intellectual ones, but the truth is that the right has done a better job in my lifetime of connecting up its philosophy and its values to its politics. Right now, I think we need to articulate the values, lay out our philosophical commitments, and then develop policies off that. And I'm working very hard not to put the cart before the horse. What do you think of that, David?
Well, I think it's very sound in terms of especially emphasizing the values. Let's just think about the debate about Medicare for All or whatever proposal we want to look at. The basic principle is that the government has a responsibility to provide health care for all Americans and to ensure that people have the health care they need. That's a radically different philosophy than that of the Republicans and Trump. How we get there, there's lots of proposals. Medicare for All might be one. Maybe there are ways of phasing it in. He's solid on the principle that this is the way our government has to be organized, but on the specific pathway He doesn't get caught up in one proposal or the other. He's trying to be flexible and recognize that if he is elected, he's going to have to work with Republicans and Democrats from progressive left side to more conservative. And I think that's people are welcoming that and the sense of values and commitments, things that we all share, and then working out in a pragmatic way what is the actual policy that's going to get us there. And I think we all have a sense, too, from Pete that, you know, he's the genuine article. He's not a career politician of the typical sort. He's honest and direct. And if he's committed to these principles and gets into office, I think we can be confident that we'll see some real progress moving in that direction. And we'll have an openness about the way in which the process is unfolding that we've not had before.
And again, I'm speaking with David Courtright, who's Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, as well as Chair of the Board of the Fourth Freedom Forum. He's the author and co-editor of 19 books, including Civil Society, Peace and Power, and Drones and the Future of Armed Conflict. And his latest book is Government for Peace. And he also is the editor of Peace Policy, an online journal published by the Kroc Institute. So since you're at Notre Dame, David, what do you know about Mayor Pete's father, who taught English at Notre Dame and is already being attacked by Fox News, who are labeling Mayor Pete's father as a dangerous Marxist. tell me about the real story with Mayor Pete's father?
I mean, I didn't have any classes with Joe Buttigieg, but he's revered in the faculty. He's a scholar of literature and of philosophy. You know, his actual beliefs I was not familiar with, and I wouldn't be able to cite any of his works. But a humanist who believed in social equity and in approaching issues in a more inclusive way, you know, very much ahead of his time in terms of his philosophical and literary beliefs. So to make him into somehow a fire-breathing Marxist is so ludicrous for anyone who knew him. He's a kindly gentleman, a scholar, beloved by his students and by his fellow faculty members. It's, you know, what we can expect. The right-wing hate machine is going to gear up to attack PETA. They do all candidates who start to show promise. But I think with Pete, they have a very different kind of person because his background is genuine. And of course, why would we want to blame Pete because of his father? He's an independent person. He didn't go to Notre Dame as a student. He went to Harvard. He created his own career, very grateful to his parents, very much so, and he loved them dearly. But they inspired him to go an independent way, and he did. And that's what we would expect as the norm from, you know, the right-wing Fox News.
You can put a positive spin on it, David. The fact that they're going after him means that they're afraid of him. So to that extent, I mean,
he's started to change in the last few weeks. You're
exactly.
Right.
He's number three now in a lot of the polls after Biden and Bernie Sanders. And, of course, Biden hasn't announced, and I don't think Biden is going to announce. I think he's just going to toy with it for the longest time because the minute he announces, I think he loses his power. As long as he's not in the race, he's an important player, and that's why he's probably number one in the polls. If you follow the trajectory that Mayor Pete's on, it's pretty extraordinary. He could be way up there within a week or so. The more he gets exposed, more the people hear him and learn about him, the more I think they're impressed. It may actually be a really important moment for America, even if he doesn't make it. The fact that he's engaging Pence in this debate, you know, saying if you've got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me, your quarrel, sir, is with my creator. This, if Mayor Pete can change the debate about religion in this country and come from the religious left position to challenge the religious right, who have usurped and confiscated the Bible as their own, and also, taken the the patriotic high ground. I mean, on both, in terms of patriotism, the right are a bunch of frauds, and in terms of religiosity, they're a bunch of frauds. And the Bible itself is pretty clear, and the Bible is on Mayor Pete's side.
Absolutely. My dear friend Jim Wallace, who is the founder of Sojourners and has written on these subjects for a very long time, he said some years ago that if we could find a candidate from the progressive side who is able to interpret the Bible and to speak biblically at times to challenge the far right, we have a real chance of transforming America. And I think we may see this in Pete. And it's so important, especially for the core issues that we face, immigration. I don't know how anyone could be call themselves religious and adhere to the Bible as either a Christian or from a Jewish tradition and not see how the Bible tells us to care for the widow, the orphan, the stranger in our midst, the need to be kind and helpful to the least of these, as Jesus said. All of these messages are permeate the New Testament and the Old Testament. And so how can one like Pence or some of the Republicans who claim to be religious enforce these policies which are so cruel and heartless towards those who are trying to escape hardships and repression in their home countries and coming to the U.S. and seeking to become citizens to gain asylum status? Just that cruelty of that policy, it seems to me, is so absolutely contrary to everything that's part of the Christian and Jewish tradition that I think for someone like Pete now to be able to speak from that religious perspective to counter those policies. And here again, going to the basic core principles, we're called to be loving towards those in need and to help those who are downtrodden and who are strangers in our midst. And how we do that and how we work out our immigration policy, of course, that's going to be complicated. But we certainly can never condone this kind of cruelty and separation of families and the bigotry and disdain towards immigrants that is being shown from the White House.
Well, exactly. How could you be a Christian and support Donald Trump? That's the question that one could ask of all of these Republicans on the religious right. But just in the literally in the last minute, David, you mentioned all of his qualifications: Rhodes Scholar, concert pianist, vet, Afghan war vet. Anything else that from the local perspective that you could give us? Any other insight?
Well, I think it's a question of the industrial heartland. I remember I spoke with him when we went down to talk to him a few days after the election. Some of us in the university, and he was very reflective, and he talked about the election as partly a cry of the industrially dispossessed. And if you look, of course, it's in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania, in these former industrial centers where so many votes swung from the Democrats over to Trump. And Pete's approach of a creative alternative, a growth strategy, a recovery strategy for old industrial cities like South Bend, I think is powerfully, it's very important, and it can be a powerful message for voters in these states especially. And if we can win in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, maybe even Ohio, then certainly you can win the national election.
Well, David Cartwright, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Cartwright, who's Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, as well as Chair of the Board of the Fourth Freedom Forum. And his latest book is Governance for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into why Trump is encouraging lawlessness and promoting vindictive and petty policies to punish his political enemies by using asylum seekers as weapons.
stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is May Nye, who's a professor of history and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her latest book is The Chinese Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, May Nye.
To be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, May. And the president tweeted out yesterday that, you know, he's on the warpath and he wants to dump immigrants coming here for political asylum on
right.
sanctuary cities, in particular Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco. He tweeted out yesterday, just out, the USA has the absolute legal right to have apprehended illegal immigrants transferred to sanctuary cities. We hereby demand that they be taken care of at the highest level, especially by the state of California, which is well known for its poor management and high taxes. Now, let me just add that the reason our taxes are high in California is that Trump deliberately skewed it in his so-called tax reform bill, the big giveaway to millionaires and billionaires, where he rewarded red states and punished blue states where he's not popular, and he took away the deduction for state and local taxes. So Californians are paying higher taxes, and they'll know about it in a couple of days.
Right. And same in New York, where I live.
And New York is the same, exactly. So this is a mean-spirited, petty man, but I think he's also a sociopath. I really think he has no humanity.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, everything he says is actually more and more bizarre, and I think they're just aimed at, you know, stoking his base, because there's no legal grounding for many of these tweets that he sends out, you know, like, I'm going to close the border. I mean, he fired his Secretary of Homeland Security because she said, I can't do that. It's not legal. And she's a pretty mean cookie herself.
Right. I think he fired her over what we're talking about there, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
This idea that you can dump immigrants on San Francisco, she obviously thought that was a bridge too far.
Right.
And he fired her. So, you know, it's an extraordinary situation. And then he asked her substitute if he would close the borders. And he said he'd pardon him if he got into trouble. I mean, this is really amazingly reckless behavior. Why is it then that people are accepting it? Has this guy lowered the bar so much and just made us immune to outrage?
Well, I think there seems to be no line he can't cross, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, taking children from their parents, you would think that would have been the line, but it wasn't. You know, there was a lot of outrage, but, you know, they're still doing it, even though they've been ordered by the courts to stop. They're still taking children from their parents. I think that there is a line that that some people feel he's crossed. He's gone too far. I think we saw that in the midterm elections. There were certain constituencies in the Republican Party who had voted for Trump in 2016 who changed their minds. So there are some sectors who think he's gone too far. And I think even someone like his own cabinet secretary, you know, says, I won't do that, right? The people for whom there is no line he can't cross are the Republicans in the Congress. They're the ones who are totally supine. They're afraid of being challenged in primary elections from the far right. And they're the ones who actually have power to do something. So I think that's the really bitter irony of it, is that you have people in the Republican Party who hold power, who have the power to stop him from many of these things, and they just simply won't. And so now we have a different game because the Democrats have the House. But, you know, it's still a divided Congress, and the Republicans, basically, on almost every issue, have just let Trump do whatever he wants, or say whatever he wants.
Well, he apparently, this kind of Rasputin figure, Stephen Miller, is the main Trump whisperer. And he seems to be essentially running, I must say, I did a forum at UCLA last week on the Mueller report. And this former FBI counterintelligence agent, Asher Rangappa, who now teaches at Yale, for some reason other than Stephen Miller's name came up, and she blamed all of the young women at Santa Monica High School who went to school with Stephen Miller for not dating him.
And that's why he's turned into the meanest meanest figure in the administration.
Right. I think there might be something to that.
Women, those girls were onto something, actually. They knew way back then.
Right. So what's your sense then of what can stop him? Because on the surface, what Trump is basically saying, since he demonized immigrants from Mexico and from Central America as murderers and rapists, and yet he wants to dump them on American cities like San Francisco. You don't have to be Einstein to connect the dots there. He's basically, if you take him at his word, he said, I'm trying to send criminals to destroy and destabilize American cities that I don't like. That's pretty disgraceful. I mean, I don't know, I can't think of a better word, but my God.
Well, I think the dynamic that we're witnessing is he says the most outrageous things. He comes up, or Miller gives him the most outrageous ideas, because I don't even know if Trump is bright enough to come up with some of these ideas. But, you know, he gets these ideas that are completely outrageous. And they actually, our challenge is that we have to tell what he could actually do, what he might actually do, and what he probably won't do. He's not going to send all these asylum seekers to San Francisco. He can't. He can't actually close the border. So some of these things are outrageous threats that his base just eats up. And, you know, he will fail in the courts. You know, the federal courts have knocked down a lot of his proposals, most of them. And then he gets by around the edges. Like I mentioned, you know, the federal court said you cannot take children from their parents. And so they said they would stop. They returned most of them who were identified at the time, but they still have not returned, you know, over 1,000 kids, and they're still finding ways to separate them that maybe on paper appear to be a little more, you know, legal. So one thing they do, Ian, for example, is that they don't technically separate them because the parents and the child are in the same detention facility. They're in the same huge warehouse. But within that facility, they have separate cages, and I literally mean cages. They have separate areas that are, you know, surrounded by chain-link fence. And so the children are in one part, and the parents or the mother is in another part, and they don't see each other. There's no communication. They're effectively separated, but because they're in the same warehouse, they're considered not to be separated, right? So they're still doing a lot of this stuff, which we need to publicized because people need to remain outraged about it. But going back to my point, I think we have to distinguish between that which he can actually do and is doing and the most outrageous things he said, which are likely not to happen and at least will be tied up in the courts, you know, for a long time. And I think where we have to point our attention is to the people in the Senate, the Congress, and the Republicans in particular. You know, I don't know what it would take for them to say, you know, this is too much. I mean, he clearly has signs of, you say he's a sociopath. I mean, he has signs of dementia. He can't speak a full sentence. And this is serious. I mean, you know, I know elderly people who have dementia. It's a very sad situation. And they should not be in charge of running the country.
So I think, though, to some extent, May, we're being trapped by him. I think Trump is enacting government by stunt and government by distraction. And
right.
You were saying earlier that he keeps riling up his base. It's true. That's what he does. He can't afford to lose him because he's already a minority president at any rate. But I think the other thing that he's doing, he's distracting all of us from his inability to govern. And I think it's also distracting us from, by beating up on these unfortunate people who are fleeing for their lives from horrible violence in these countries and from global warming, from the effects of global warming, which are destroying the agriculture in Honduras.
Right.
You know, essentially what he's doing is he's a fraud. He is not even a billionaire, but he's given the store away to the billionaires and his people, and he's screwed everybody else, particularly, we said at the beginning, in New York and California, you'll wake up when you have to pay taxes and realize you've been screwed. That's the real story. This guy ran as a populist to take care of average folk, and he's actually taking care of Wall Street people. And that's where the big fraud is. So why not talk about blame it all on the Mexicans, you know?
Exactly. And I think the more danger he appears to be in, the more crazy he gets, right? So, you know, we still haven't seen the Mueller's report. It's not maybe the smoking gun that many liberals hoped it would be, but I think, you know, it's 400 pages, and I think there's some damning stuff in it. And I don't know how long Barr can keep it under wraps or how heavily he can redact it. I think it's going to come out. At some point, sooner than later, that report's going to come out. And so I think there's always a correlation between things that threaten Trump's position, which would be strong evidence of bad behavior, if not criminal behavior. And, you know, the Mueller report only dealt with, there's still, I think, 16 other investigations going on, many of which are taking place in the Southern District of New York, which is where his business operations are based. They are going full throttle investigating his finances. And, you know, I'm not hopeful that he'll ever release his tax returns. I think it'll go all the way to the Supreme Court, where he's got now enough friends to protect him. But, Ian, the point is that whenever he feels threatened, whenever there's a proximate threat to his own position, his family, his finances, his Russian connections, whatever, there's a correlation between that and him going crazy about Mexicans and Central Americans.
Well, the Mueller report may well be out on Tuesday. My understanding is that it's going to be about 60% redacted.
Right.
And one of the things that came out of the forum that I mentioned I did last week at UCLA Hammer Museum on the Mueller report, Scott Horton from Columbia Law School, they were all very pessimistic, Malcolm Nance and Usher and Gupper and Scott, that the fix was in with Barr. So we're trying to figure out what motivates Barr, and what came out, which I thought was insightful, was that Barr is a very conservative, zealous Catholic and close to Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Societies, and that Barr may not care much about Trump, but he wants to keep Trump in there so that Leonard Leo can get all of these right-wing judges on the courts. And then that might well be what this whole exercise is about.
Right. I mean, they keep – and that's also the Republicans have you know, in the Senate have the same agenda. They want to stack the courts with super conservative people, pro-business, anti-regulation, et cetera. So that is, you know, aside from what you were mentioning before, his attacks on middle-class people and working-class people and his helping the rich. I mean, another dimension of that agenda is definitely wanting to stack the federal courts with conservatives who will continue to promote that agenda. I mean, that's what the Republicans really get from Trump. He distracts from their putting into place their agenda. And actually, it's remarkable that they've done as little of that as possible, and there's been a lot of deregulation. But aside from the tax cut, you know, they were not able to overturn the Affordable Care Act. You know, so I think, you know, they have not been able to dismantle everything completely. I mean, if we can get somebody else in there in 2020 and change the face of the Congress, you know, we may be able to reverse some of these things. But a lot of damage has been done, no doubt about it.
Well, I think you're you know, one of the things I was sorry that I didn't mention at the end of the forum, because everybody was so certain that the fix was in and that the report, Mueller report, will be sort of so sanitized it won't be particularly effective. I think you're right. I think there will be enough in it to be very damaging. And then, of course, that will whet the appetite for all of the redacted stuff.
Right. I think eventually it'll come out.
Right. So just in the last couple of minutes, I mean, I have to mention another piece of the Trump distraction. These attacks on Congresswoman Ilhan Omar tying her to 9/11, and now she's getting all kinds of death threats. Again, that seems to be such a clear, clarion example of the politics of distraction and stirring hatred. I mean, he does the same with immigrants. And, you know, cutting off the meager funds that we give these countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, is so counterintuitive. I'm kind of disappointed that the Democrats can't make a stronger case that the obvious way to solve the immigration problem in this country is to make life more livable in the countries from which these people have to flee. They wouldn't be, you know, I'm sure they would prefer to live in a stable environment in their own homeland, but they can't.
And right. Well, right. But because I think the problem is more than financial aid or monetary assistance. You have basically failed states. You have terrible political situations there. And the United States is also responsible for their politics having gotten to this point. So that's the harder fix. And, you know, an American intervention, political and military, is, I think, the wrong way to go, the absolute wrong way to go. So I don't, you know, it's very hard to say now what the solution is in many parts of the world where there is incredible violence, failed states, you know, no order or law or rule of law, ethnic and religious factions. And I think part of the problem is that the United States has had a hand in creating or exacerbating these conflicts. But the United States, if it actually intervenes more directly, would only make those problems worse. So, well, Ian, I don't know the solution to,
right.
to the
well,
world.
No, I understand that.
But clearly, you know, he's blown up this problem of the Central American migrants into something far bigger numerically than it is. And the sleight of hand that I think is really dangerous that they have done is they have turned people who are seeking asylum into illegal aliens. An asylum seeker has the right, you know this, right, under international and domestic law to enter the country and make a claim. And then the claim has to be vetted. It has to be adjudicated. But, you know, most people, you know, the majority of people who make asylum claims are granted asylum. So he's turned them into illegal aliens, people who are trying to invade the country. If they get in, they're undocumented. They should be sent to San Francisco, you know, or wherever, you know. And he's kind of reconfigured the asylum seeker into an illegal. And that itself is illegal.
Right.
You know, that itself is illegal on the part of the administration. But this is part of the whole demonization, is to paint all immigrants, especially brown ones, as illegal immigrants. And that's the world we live in today. And people, you know, need to see past that and see it for what it is.
Well, May Nye, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure to talk, Ian.
Well, thank you. And so again, much. I've been speaking with May Nye, who's Professor of History and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens, and the Making of Modern America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.